Hi, Patrick Cox here in Boston, and what a pod we have for you today. In Canada, bilingualism is getting bold and chubby and finally developing a sense of its own identity. Yep, the language laws up north have turned 40. Also, we remember two men of the 20th century. One wrote and rewrote the lyrics to Russia's national anthem. The other helped break Nazi codes, but was hounded to his death by the British government.
As a free man, I take pride in the word, Ich bin ein Berliner.
Why, as an American, do I have to push a button to speak English?
Absolute, the biggest load of chicken droppings I've heard in a long time, Jeremy, I have to say.
The World in Words podcast and the World Radio program are both produced by the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH in Boston. The World, the big show, is on more than 280 public radio stations around the United States. You can listen online at theworld.org. Go there to check out all of our other podcasts on technology, history, global politics, the economy, science, books. It's all there. I post show notes for The World in Words at theworld.org/language. There's also a World in Words group on Facebook, and I'm also on Twitter. Today, the man behind the words to two national anthems that share the same music. Also, a feisty exchange with the original enforcer of Canada's language laws. Sounds funny saying enforcer in the same sentence as Canada. Anyway, those language laws turned 40 this past week, and a move to rehabilitate a Brit who helped break the Nazis' war codes, a man who died young and was treated shoddily by his own government. First, poet Sergei Mikhalkov, a man very much embedded in Russian history. Mikhalkov died late last month in Moscow at the age of 96. He was best known for writing lyrics for this little ditty. This is, of course, the national anthem of Russia. It was also the anthem of the old Soviet Union. Mikhalkov wrote different lyrics for each. Here's the big show's Alex Galifant.
The story of Russia's national anthem doesn't begin with Sergei Mikhalkov. For that, we go back to this. God Save the Tsar was Russia's national anthem from the early 1830s. The words are kind of what you'd expect. God save the noble Tsar, long may he live, etc., etc., standard stuff. And it worked fine, until 1917, when revolution entered the bloodstream. By 1922, a workers' anthem was in the throats of Russians, the Internationale. No one will grant us deliverance, rang the words. Not God, nor Tsar, nor hero. But a hero figure did emerge, at least in Soviet propaganda, Joseph Stalin. And the hero needed an anthem. The hymn of the Bolshevik Party was written in 1939. Its words praised the party of Lenin, the party of Stalin, wise party of Bolsheviks. But Stalin commissioned new lyrics from the late Sergei Mikhalkov. The new anthem was unveiled in 1944. Here it is in an English translation recorded the following year.
The days dark and stormy while great Lenin led us.
And yes, this is the American Paul Robeson singing, a longtime supporter of the Soviet experiment.
And Stalin, our leader, with faith in the people.
Stalin's cult of personality made a name check necessary. But when he died in 1953, the Soviet Union began to de-Stalinize the country. That included the national anthem. For the next couple of decades, the Soviet Union did without lyrics. But in 1977, Sergei Mikhalkov popped up again. This time, he left Stalin out and focused on Lenin. Now the refrain referred to the party of Lenin, the strength of our peoples, and communism's triumph. That's how it stayed, until the Soviet Union collapsed in the early 1990s. Boris Yeltsin scrapped the old anthem, replacing it with a tune by the 19th century composer Mikhail Glinka. Yeltsin held a competition for lyrics. Here's the winner. Save your breath. Yeltsin was out of power before the words had been officially unveiled. Vladimir Putin took over. He brought back the old tune, and for a third time, the state turned to Sergei Mikhalkov for new lyrics. The current refrain goes, "Be glorious, our free fatherland, long-lasting union of brotherly peoples, common wisdom given by our forebears. Be glorious, our country, we are proud of you." National anthems are meant to sound like they've existed for all of time. They're bits of musical mythology. But old tunes have a habit of cropping up in strange places. Take the one we started with, "God Save the Tsar." Over here, the tune has another home, the University of Pennsylvania. For the world, I'm Alex Galifian.
That song, Save the Tsar, isn't used only in the U.S. by the University of Pennsylvania. Since 1912, the alma mater, the official anthem of Los Angeles High School, has been sung to this tune as well. Los Angeles High School is the oldest public high school in the American Southwest. It was founded in 1872, thanks to Will Allen for this. He is president of the Los Angeles High School Alumni Association. Here's another national anthem. This anthem has undergone some word changes too. Actually, it became bilingual. There is an official English version and an official French one. But these days, performers often switch mid-verse from French to English or vice versa. There is an official bilingual law in Canada. When you enter the country, for example, you'll be greeted by a sign that says "Welcome" and "Bienvenue." Canada's bilingual law came into effect 40 years ago, and on the big show, we thought it'd be interesting to check in with Keith Spicer. Spicer was Canada's first ever Commissioner of Official Languages, the guy who was charged with enforcing the official languages law. And as you'll hear, he's a true believer in that law and how it's changed Canada. The Big Show's Marco Werman spoke with him.
First off, Keith Spicer, explain what the Official Languages Act was, and practically speaking, what changed under it?
Okay. Until 1969, Canada was officially unilingual, English only. And all during the 1960s in Quebec, there had been a rising tide of separatism and nationalism, and there had even been a little bit of violence, although since we're Canadian, we hold tea parties rather than kill people. And we had an independent commission on called Bilingualism and Biculturalism that recommended an Official Languages Act as part of the solution for making French-speaking Canadians feel at home in Canada. So the law was proclaimed 40 years ago this week, and it made French and English equal in status, rights, and privileges in all federal administrations. And it became a symbol of the Canadian identity. And now, 40 years later, even though the law was contested by a lot of Anglo-Canadians who saw their power seeping away, it's now accepted by everybody as one of the fundamental values of the Canadian identity.
So it sounds like it was the politics of secession in Quebec that prompted this, because French and English had been coexisting sort of for hundreds of years in Canada.
They had been, but what the change started in 1960. Quebec had been, well, it was called a theocracy at the time. They had a pretty backward government and society at the time, basically run by the Catholic Church and English big business. And they had this kind of lascivious tango to keep the ordinary French Canadians in Quebec down. So it looked quiet, but underneath, all of a sudden, when the Prime Minister of Quebec, who was implementing this obscurantist policy, when he died, the roof went off Quebec. Everything changed. A new modern government came into play with a former Federalist politician, a French Canadian, and there was tremendous intellectual ferment. They're saying now we've got to modernize our society, and in modernizing it, they demanded their place in the sun. You're right, it was the threat of Quebec secession that propelled the federal government into adopting this act, for which there was no particular demand previously, not even in Quebec.
You say the act was accepted, but was it accepted even in very Anglophone provinces like Alberta?
Yes, it was, but it took a little while. There were plenty of people against it. There was fury in the land of English-speaking Canada for quite a while. There are still tiny, tiny pockets of people who are, since I'm 75, I can say it, people over 60. But basically, there are two generations of kids who have grown up with this, learned French in school. I'm talking of English Canada. Well, we started at that time, 1969, a huge movement for French immersion in English-Canadian schools. Now there are 2 or 3 million, more than that, probably 5 million adult Canadians, English-speaking Canadians, who can get along very well in French. And so there has been a very large acceptance of this. It's taken a while for it to seep in, but people have realized, particularly when they go overseas, that people in other countries like the idea of a peaceful kingdom that has integrated its diversity into a law making everybody equal.
There was a poll conducted recently in Western Canada that shows that a lot of people still don't accept this. They don't like it.
You can always fix a poll by picking the audience. Of course you can. I once ran an 8-month poll. We consulted 700,000 Canadians. That's a lot more than the 1,000 people you get in a poll. We consulted everybody, coast to coast, all three oceans, including the Arctic. And massively, and this was 15 years ago, people said official bilingualism is a fundamental part of the Canadian identity and we want to keep it. And any national poll that you get now will say the same thing. It's really part of the woodwork. When I started off in a rather hairy and scary environment in which we had deep French-Canadian skepticism, if not cynicism, some anger in English-speaking Canada, which needed to be addressed, and it was, the so-called ethnocultural groups, Slovaks, Germans, and others, and the native peoples all felt left out. So I went out of my way to make the job into a job of traveling salesman for linguistic duality and linguistic tolerance. And we had huge programs for youth using provocation and humor, and the same for the civil servants in Ottawa. That was a major effort. We had to convert the English-speaking civil servants who were going to lose jobs out of this, so lose competitions for jobs. They had pretty well a monopoly on them, and now all of a sudden the French-speaking Canadians were able to compete and work in their own language. So it did take time, and of course you can, if you pick a certain city, and I would say Ottawa, Moncton, Winnipeg, these are towns where there's competition over jobs, federal jobs, of course you can find a little bit of tension, but it's really insignificant.
Did the Official Languages Act mean that all federal workers in Canada suddenly had to become bilingual? A lot of people seem to believe this.
No, not at all. Yeah. Not at all. All federal administrations, offices, departments, and agencies had to have bilingual capacity. No single federal employee had to become bilingual. And if they wanted to, in order to compete for supervisory jobs, which were usually declared officially bilingual, the government would pay for their language training, even if it went on for 2 or 3 years. So it was a pretty good deal for the English-speaking civil servant. Here, we don't believe much in lawyers in this country. We sort of sit around our campfire and talk things through until we either fall asleep or solve the problem. And the changes that made this institutional tolerance work was constant discussion and consultation with unions, NGOs, language groups, everybody. So everybody was brought into the great national canoe, and now it's sailing along very nicely. I would not deny that there's not the odd bit of flack here and there. I still get a little fan mail from very elderly people like me, hammering me for what I did 40 years ago. But now no serious person is opposed to the law. I'll give you an example. 40 years ago, there was not a single English-speaking politician anywhere in Canada who could get along in French. Now, every cabinet minister, every prime minister must speak fluent French. We have national debates in election time. There's an English debate and a French debate. And even if the guy comes from the West, as our current prime minister has, Stephen Harper, they speak very good French now. Now, this is staggering. It's a revolution. I don't know. If you imagine in the United States what would happen if over a period of 20, 30, 40 years, you had all national politicians, cabinet ministers, the president, having to speak fluent Spanish and conduct debates in Spanish, you get the picture.
Well, as long as you're talking about the United States, south of the border here in the U.S., I mean, we've passed official English ordinances and laws that are often voter approved. Many here feel having more than one language is a challenge to national identity. What do you think is different in Canada?
Not at all. I find, well, you can't have 45 national languages, although India has, I think, 26. But what you have to do is try to be fair and functional about these things and consult people, make it voluntary at the beginning. I'm not in favor of waving red flag in front of people. The way we did it in Canada was not to use lawyers, although we did have a law. I, as commissioner, I had what I call the star chamber powers, a kind of hydrogen bomb powers. I never used them. I said, if we have to use the law, then we're killing the law. So we use seduction, laughter, believe it or not, constantly. I wrote reports that were really deliberately provocative and funny, and teasing everybody on earth, making fun of prejudice, the Archie Bunkers of the country, and these were in official government reports. We got the whole country laughing with us. Then I would slip in the message, okay, time for some fair play. The French-speaking Canadians pay their taxes in French. Why not give them some services in French and let them work in French?
Do you think, though, there is something particular about Canadian identity? Because a lot of people here in the United States, I think, feel threatened by another language.
Well, yes, we have a completely different history from that of the United States. It's a long story, but we did not settle the West with guns. We settled them with Mounties, unarmed Mounties, walking into a bar and saying, "In the name of the Queen, I arrest you." And everybody went along because he had the red coat. And basically, this is a country there whose whole instincts over a period of 300 years have been towards compromise and getting along well and never mind sharpening things too much, because we think that constructive ambiguity is much better than sharply defined law. And much of this is based on the Official Languages Act and the way it was applied.
What about other language groups in Canada, Native Canadians or First Nations as they're known, or, you know, the Cantonese speakers in Vancouver,
millions of them?
Did the Official Languages Act create a precedent?
No, what it did, because there was a section of the Act that said nothing in the current Act can be used to harm any rights or privileges that already exist for these languages. And I would spend a lot of time talking to Ukrainian groups and Indian and Inuit groups explaining this and say, to be honest, there's nothing in this act for you, but nothing in it to hurt you either. And if you can show us any customary rights you have, I'll defend them the same way as I will French and English. Meanwhile, the government developed a parallel multicultural program which shovels huge amounts of money for language schools in any language that immigrants want. When an immigrant gets off the plane in Canada, we basically say, look, we don't have a lot of history in Canada, but you do, coming from India or whatever. If you want to keep your language for your children, we'll pay for your kids' education in Hindi up to maybe grade 3. We do that. And there's, I don't know, close to 75 or 100 languages, immigrant languages, that are subsidized by the federal government. Now, I guess this is kind of sneaky, because the idea is to make these immigrants feel so much at home that the language issue is no longer a problem because their kids solve it for them.
You know, some of the rules in Montreal, though, like in the 90s, where it seemed to be a little outrageous. Do you think it went overboard at some point?
Yes, of course it did. And when you have to look sympathetically at the French-speaking Quebecers. Their province had an English face for 100 years or more, 200 years. And they wanted to put a French face on it. And so they laid down some laws.
So, Keith Spicer, how is your French these days? Ça va bien?
Ça va très bien. Yeah, well, I live in Paris, you know. I've been there for 13 years.
Okay.
I went overboard, and so I overflew Quebec and went to France just because I had a hopeless love affair with Paris. I plead guilty to that. I'm not on the lam because of angry anti-bilingual people here. It's because I really was in love with France.
Well, as a Francophile, I suppose you made a very good first commissioner of official languages.
I guess so. I had the advantage of being totally unknown in English-speaking Canada and a little bit known in French Canada because I've been a lot on TV.
Keith Spicer was Canada's first commissioner of official languages. He's now a writer and journalist based in Paris, but spoke to us today in English from Ottawa. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's stay in Canada for eating sideways. That's when I pick a foreign expression that defies straightforward English translation. This week, it's French. It has to be French, Canadian French. And the expression is ferme ton gorlot. And you spell gorlot, G-O-R-L-O-T. It's a Quebecois word for sleigh bell. So literally, the expression means stop ringing your sleigh bell. Or more simply put, shut up. Now, the expression gorlot has several metaphorical meanings in Quebecois, not all of which I could repeat in this family-friendly podcast. In any case, it's a variation of the standard French for sleigh bell, which is grelot. Now, we're going to consider another instance in which an expert in language, in this case codes and breaking them, runs into trouble because of his sexual orientation. You may have heard in podcast number 60 about the Pentagon's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy, which means that openly gay soldiers are discharged from the military, and how one unintended effect of this policy has been the loss of thousands of bilingual servicemen and women, people who speak languages like Arabic, languages that the government has deemed to be critical. Well, this is a story about a gay man in England, not in the military, but very much engaged in the war effort during World War II. And it's important to know that homosexuality was illegal in England at the time. Alan Turing was the man in question. He was a mathematician, and he contributed to the defeat of Germany by cracking secret Nazi codes. He was also gay, and that caused him a huge amount of trouble. The 1996 TV movie Breaking the Code dramatized Turing's life. Here he is, played by Derek Jacobi, as he gets some advice from his boss, who's played by Richard Johnson.
I do think you might be a little more discreet. Tongues are beginning to wag.
Am I in for a lesson in morals?
In common sense. I mean, I don't give a tuppenny damn whether you choose to go to bed with choir boys or cocker spaniels, but it would be wiser to keep your private life to yourself.
Is this an official reprimand?
Friendly advice, nothing more.
Now, once Alan Turing's secret was out, he was prosecuted for, quote, gross indecency, and he was forced to undergo hormonal treatments. His life unraveled, and he killed himself in 1954. At the age of 41. Recently, a campaign took hold to get the British government to apologize for the way it treated Turing. And a few days ago, British Prime Minister Gordon Brown did just that. He called the treatment meted out to Turing inhumane. Well, Richard Gill was one of the people who pushed for that apology. He's a professor of mathematical statistics at the University of Leiden in the Netherlands, and he spoke with the Big Show's Lisa Mullins.
Alan Turing's one of the giants of the 20th century. I think, as far as I know, a perfectly decent man. He did such important work. He did so much important work for Britain and the US, for that matter.
What's your own personal connection to Alan Turing?
Well, I have some sort of small, odd personal connections. For instance, my mother actually worked at Bletchley Park during the war, where they were breaking the codes, applying the algorithms which Turing had figured out in order to break the secret codes which were being used to direct the U-boats to sink British and American shipping. So my mother was one of many young ladies who just sat there turning wheels on machines for doing long calculations, long multiplications and additions and so on. And it was very exciting because they knew they had broken the codes from time to time. That's one little connection.
As you say, he was a brilliant mathematician. What did it take in that time to break the Nazi code?
It's like solving a puzzle. I mean, like solving a Sudoku puzzle. You know, you have to systematically try this and this and this. If you very systematically do the right steps in the right order, and it's like getting out of a maze. You know, if you keep your right hand on the wall, you will get out. So in that sense, he didn't invent a computer for solving that. He invented a method, an algorithm, we would say.
Alan Turing was called the father of computer science. Can you tell us why?
Well, he thought very deeply about what a computer could do. So I would call him like the father of theoretical computer science, or a father of theoretical computer science, and all these ideas of the theory of codes and cryptography, making secret codes. There's a whole lot of developments in mathematics and in computer science, which are all around this circle of ideas, and a whole lot of technology, like whether or not your internet banking is safe and things like that, sort of depends on these ideas, this kind of mathematics, and it's a basis of a lot of important computer science and computer applications.
Richard Gill, professor of mathematical statistics at the University of Leiden in the Netherlands, thank you very much.
It was a great pleasure.
That's it for this week. See you on Facebook or Twitter, or you can email me. The address is language@pri.org. See you next week.